All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears? What's happening? It's Mark Maron. This is WTF, my podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being with me during this interesting time in the world. Today, Chris Hayes is on the show. Now, Chris Hayes is one of the smart guys. He's solid. His scholarship is solid. His cultural criticism and political criticism, solid. Bright dude. What's he like as a person? Who I don't fucking know. I know more now because I talked to him. It was interesting to talk to him because he's a journalist guy and he's an earnest dude, you know, and he means it. He's a political commentator. And as some of you know, I did my time doing a bit of political talk way back, and I decided that it was not for me to do because my passions lied elsewhere. Well, maybe I should rephrase that. My anger lied elsewhere. It lied wherever it would, I would lay it. I don't want to divide. I want to embrace and bring people together in their pain and insanity and make us know that we're all very similar and that our fears and frustrations and hopes, dreams, and horrendous dark places are the same with very little variation. Where none of us are that profoundly unique or necessarily interesting in our fucking insanity and problems. So why wedge the political axe in the middle of that? I think if more people dealt with their personal problems and personal issues and really sort of owned up to them and sat in themselves comfortably, we'd have a much more interesting and realistic political dialogue. And that's where it ends for me today. We'll stay in the trenches of self, if you don't mind. I'm going to be doing some international travel in Dublin, Ireland. I'll be at Vickers Street on Wednesday, September 2nd. On Thursday, September 3rd, I will be at the South Bank Center in London, England, as well as September 4th there again. I hear tickets are selling well. I haven't been there in years. I've never been to Dublin. I think I was there once at the airport, leaving. After being in Kilkenny, which was okay, not a great experience, but I'm excited about Dublin. Then on Thursday, October 15th, I'll be at the State Theatre in Sydney, Australia. On October 16th, I will be at the Palace Theatre in Melbourne, Australia. And October 17th, I will be in Brisbane City Hall in Brisbane, right? Australia. I'm looking forward to these trips. I've not done England or Australia in years. I was at the Melbourne Festival, and it's going to be fun to be where I'm at now and to be there. And who knows, maybe it'll be like the most exciting international travel of my life. I do tell you, be honest with you, between me and you, once I get on the plane, once I get to where I'm going, once I get into a hotel room that I'm not really responsible for in some ways, not that I'm going to do any damage, but there's a peace to it. There's a peace to it, and I'm looking for some peace of mind because I almost lost my fucking mind the other night, if you don't mind me saying. Yeah, I came unhinged a little bit, and I think some of you saw it coming. Over bullshit, but yeah, this is just, it is what it is. It's the way my brain works. It's just the way my brain works. I had the health panic, so I went to the cardiologist, and I tried to cajole him into believing that I was... pretty sick, that my heart, my ticker was going. But he did the similar test that I had the other doctor. He said everything seems fine for now, but he said we'll do a stress test. We're gonna do a cardiogram. So I'm gonna do that, not next week, but the week after. I was gonna do it next week because I was fueled by panic, and I thought, like, I'm a time bomb. I'm a ticking time bomb. I better go get this shit done because I know something he doesn't know, even though he didn't seem very stressed about it. About the situation. So here's what happened. You want to know how I lost my mind? I bought a car, and the dude over there at Glendale Toyota, Alejandro, man, he helps me out. So we got the car, they cleaned it up, and I got a black Toyota Camry hybrid. That's right. I had a Camry, and I just got a little nicer Camry. You know why? Because between you and I don't give a fuck about cars. I just need, like, I sold my car, the classic shitbox, baseline Camry that had nothing in it that I bought online without driving it in 2005. Just ordered it online. They drove it to my house. I gave them a check. And I've been driving that, for the last 100,000 miles, a little less. I just don't care. I don't want to have a car I care about. So I sold that to Ryan Singer. I gave him the Comedian Pal price. Guy's out on the road. He's hoofing it out there. He's going town to town doing the business, driving across country. That thing as a Toyota still got a lot of life on it. Ryan's a good friend of mine. I gave it to him for $1,000. Toyota Camry, 2006. 95,000 and change on it. Gave it to him for $1,000 because I know it's going to go to a good cause. Ryan's fucking swinging those jokes out there in the middle of nowhere doing the fucking job. And that's a comedian's car. And a comedian needs it. So there you go. That's that story. We'll see where that car takes Ryan Singer. I'm going to interview him about where that car takes him and what happens in that car from here on out. That'll be a secondary series, a sub-series of the show. All right. So I'm excited about my new car. I'm driving it around. Pick up the girl, pick up Sarah. We drive it around. I say, what do you think, baby? She says, nice. It's got the Bluetooth, got the whole business. I don't know how to work anything in the car yet, but it's exciting. So then, nighttime starts to come, and I drop Sarah off after I give her a little cruise in the car. And I'm driving home, and I'm like, these headlights kind of suck. And then I get into my driving, like, well, that's because there's no headlights at all. The switch is on, headlights not working. What the fuck is this about? So in that moment, this is the way my brain works. It's like, who can I call right now to fucking lose my shit on over this new car I bought today that's got non-functioning headlights? Where do I start tweeting at Toyota? Like, I had to restrain a pen and tongue, as they say in the secret society. But, you know, I tried to keep it together, but my brain's been going a little haywire lately because I think things are going too well for me. So I don't freak out. Instead, I set my clock for 6:15. I'm going to be the first on the service line because I just leased that car and I got a fucking beef and I'm going to lose my shit. So I drive down to Toyota Glendale, 7 in the morning. I'm there. I'm the first, fourth or fifth person there. Met this dude, Mike, from Jersey. We talked Jersey for a little while. We hit it off. I tell him about the headlights. He's like, yeah, man, I don't think I've ever seen that before. Then finally the service manager comes in, older guy. White-haired dude, seemed like a nice guy. I told him what was up. He said, I never heard of that before. And of course, I'm thinking, fuck, a unique electrical problem on my new fucking car. Welcome to Lemonland, motherfucker. That's what I said to myself inside. But I didn't express those feelings outwardly. I said, really? Never seen this before? So what's going on? So I sit there and wait, and I'm freaking out because I think, like, now it's just going to be a battle with this new car. Boy, that new car buzz didn't last very long. Then old dude, white-haired dude, nice dude, comes into the waiting area and says, there's no bulbs. There's no bulbs in the headlights. And I'm like, what the fuck? No bulbs? How the fuck did that happen? But it was probably the best case scenario because that means my electrical system wasn't fucked. He's like, I don't know. And I'm like, no bulbs. That happened on the assembly line? They just forgot to put the bulbs in. I've never seen it. It's a big deal over at the service area. How the hell did this not have bulbs? Maybe some kid or somebody lifted them when they were on the lot. But then it became sort of like, I don't know if we got these bulbs. I'm like, this is the Toyota place. He said, well, if you wait till the sales guys come, maybe we can take them out of another car. And then out of nowhere, this mystical service elf shows up. This little guy goes, I got him. And I'm like, yeah. So I don't know where he came from, but that's all he said. He just waved a baggie like a guy who just got his drugs. Little baggie, I got him. I'm like, dude, put those fuckers in. So that worked out. So now the bulbs are working. That was a close one. And now I'm happy about my car again. But anyways, a lot of things were going on all at once and my brain exploded and I yelled a bit. And I tried to start a fight with my girlfriend. And I yelled at my manager because there was too much coming in and I had to I got to travel and I'm getting my driveway done. And that was, everything was going to happen at once. The deck, the driveway, there was going to be demo here. I got interviews next week. And I just, because I have no capacity anymore, and I'm not sure I ever did to see more than a day or two ahead. And that means schedule. That means everything. It's like, everything's a fucking surprise to me. Like a goddamn child. I'm like, oh my God, I'm getting on a plane tomorrow. So like, I just short-circuited. And I started texting Brendan, who some of you know now. I'd like to read that directly to you because if you have a question about how to handle a Marc Maron in your life, I was losing my mind and I didn't know where to put my frustration because I couldn't make a decision about something. I'm just texting Brendan. Just like, what the fuck am I going to do? There's too much going on. I don't know how I can handle the schedule. Blah, 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 blah. I don't need to get into specifics. I sent like 20 texts. Just spinning down the fucking hole of self. Like my brain was short-circuiting because there was going to be work done on my house all at the same time, that I got to do interviews and I got to travel. And, you know, there was just a million things. After a certain point, everything starts to happen at the same frequency. Like, hey, somebody just texted me and wants to go to lunch. That's exactly the same as, you know, I have to fly to Australia. They all come at me with the same intensity. So at some point, there was this text. I said, maybe you don't understand what the fuck I'm dealing with here. I texted that, and he had not really responded to anything because I was in a flurry of panic and anger just coming through in text form. Maybe you don't understand what the fuck I'm dealing with here, I said. And then a little text balloon goes, Brendan just texts back, call me if you're going to do this. That stopped the fury. That stopped the frenzy. So then I'm like, then I call him. I'm like, hey, man, okay, I'm sorry about all the texts. I just, I don't know. This is my fucking mind. And he gave me a suggestion to move some things forward, to clear out time, to look at my calendar and see where I could possibly do the things that I just spontaneously let happen. And I said, no, I can't. I'm not going to be able to change that. And everything was able to be changed. And I did not have a stroke. Call me if you're going to do this. See, that's where texting falls off. Is that, you know, when the excited kind of like, you know, I'm fucked, flurry of texts happens, and you just go, you know what? Maybe this is something you should do, you know, with your you know, call me. And then it all went away. And that's why we've worked together for so long. Did I mention I saw my wildcat, scaredy cat, the one with the fucked up mouth, just popped a fucking skunk right in the head. Just popped him right in the head. Skunk was looking around. They were both kind of waiting for food. And fucking scaredy cat was just sitting there on the step of the deck being cool. Fucking skunk is spinning around, sniffing the air, looking for food. Got a little too close to scaredy cat. Pop. Boom. Right in the nose. Skunk didn't even know what to do. He's like, am I going to spray this motherfucker? Am I going to, you know, make some weird noises with my feet and jump around in a weird way to see if that has an effect? Yeah, I'll try those. Well, I'm not going to spray yet because it takes a lot to bounce back from that shit. So I'll just do a little weird panic dance and see if that works. Check, look at what my tail does, motherfucker. Nothing, huh? Scaredy just held his ground. Skunk freaked out, went away. Then I fed that cat. That's a tough cat. That cat don't give a fuck. All right, let's see who Chris Hayes really is. Or let's have a conversation with him. You know, you get a sense of the guy. You know, we're not going to talk like he talks on the TV show. We're going to talk like a couple guys talking. Maybe I should give him all his credit. Chris Hayes has a show on MSNBC called All In with Chris Hayes, and that airs weeknights at 8 p.m. on MSNBC. Did I mention that twice? Chris Hayes, right now with me in the garage. After I talked to the president, like, I know that choices were made, that he decided to do this show. It wasn't a fluke.
Right.
But then when you're talking to a politician, like, people ask me if I was nervous, but I talked to politicians before. So how do you get that guy to be a person and not, you know, get that front? And I think just the nature of the intimacy of it, yep, made it a very different experience.
Yep.
But he must have had an agenda on something. I think he said it was to sort of reach out to people who were apolitical, in a sense.
Yeah, I think they are very attuned to the fact that there is this proliferation of channels,
yeah,
by which people can be reached. And in some ways, those are frontiers that have yet to be settled,
right,
by other people. Mm-hmm. So, and I think they're very smart about that.
They can sort of come around the side.
Yeah, that's exactly right, where it's like, oh, well, there's all these people that listen to this person. There's
right.
All these people that not only listen to this person, but I think in a very savvy way, like, trust this person.
Right. Right.
There's a sort of vouching and validation that happens.
Yeah.
And sometimes the best way to get your message out, quote unquote,
yeah,
is when you're not in a situation where you're explicitly...
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Sure. Like, sure. Because, and I think just that was the feedback was really like, I think that a lot of people just kind of like stop giving a shit.
about, you know, him or what he had to say. You know, just in the general population, people who are not necessarily politically minded or keeping up had just sort of dismissed him as, well, this is the president. And that's that. So I think that a lot of the feedback I got was people saying, like, I forgot how much I liked that guy.
Right.
Yeah. So he did something.
Right. That's right. That's right. And it that goes back to the point that the two of you made, which is a point that I think about a lot, which is we are capable of relating to all sorts of people and bonding with all sorts of people and having affection, admiration for all sorts of people whose politics we don't share when we take the politics.
That's
out, right. Right. You know,
that was an important thing. And it's one of the reasons why I stopped doing politics. I mean, I don't know how you walk through the world on a day-to-day basis with, you know, 48% of the population go, that's that fucking guy. Do you have to deal with that?
You know, it's only happened to me twice. And I'm lucky enough that...
Twice? That's it? Out in the world?
Or yeah, because my...
They don't watch.
My, exactly. Exactly. My particular level of the very specific strata of fame and or notoriety I have is such that it is mostly only to the people who like what I do.
Yeah.
As opposed to broadly to the people that would hate me, right? So I'm not walking around like Michael... Like, Michael Moore is sort of this, like... identifiable icon
for
a certain kind of conservative.
Right.
So I just don't attract that. One time I was in New York once and my child had needed to be changed in a Starbucks and was and she was wailing.
Yeah.
And this guy was like start berating me about ruining the country.
Really?
And I was just like, hey buddy, I don't care. And I take care of my kid.
That was it. That was it.
And that's and a few other times people have in passing said things, but I've never had like some, you know, confrontation.
You don't feel compelled to argue at every turn if somebody approaches you in the street?
I don't. One of the things that I loved the most when I first started being a journalist was the feeling, the relief, the unburdening of not being compelled to argue. Like that all my job was to listen.
Right.
I would go and report on things. I'd go to an evangelical college to the convocation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just liberating to say, I'm not here to persuade these people that I have the right politics, and I'm not here to convert anyone to my worldview. I just want to hear what, I'm just going to listen. And it's an amazing unburdening that happens when you are in a position where I don't feel any, it's not incumbent upon me to argue.
Well, but now it is.
Now it is. I know.
See, what'd you do to yourself? See what you did. You sold out. Now you gotta argue.
Well, let me say this though. We argue a lot, but I mean, I've spent 4 or 5 days here in California. We're doing this show on the drought, and you know, I always spent all day with a Central Valley farmer,
right?
Who I think is very different politics.
Can you get me up to speed on the drought? Because I think I'm. I might water my yard once too many times a week. Am I? How much of the onus is on me, Chris?
Have
you learned?
It's about 80% Marin. Sort of the line.
I figured. I knew it.
The water authorities.
What are you finding? Well, let's go back. So when you were a journalist and you had a certain amount of anonymity other than a byline, how did you get into that? Let's start at the beginning, like in a logical way. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Bronx.
The Bronx. Like what kind of family? Like working class?
Yeah,
middle class?
It was a working class, middle class family. It was in the Bronx in the 80s. My mom is from the Bronx. Her father had a mozzarella shop in an Italian neighborhood in the Bronx.
In Arthur, like on Arthur Avenue?
On Arthur Avenue.
A mozzarella shop.
Literally,
your grandfather.
My grandfather.
Made the good shit.
Exactly right.
Do you remember him?
Yeah. He died when I was about 7, I think, but yeah.
Do you remember the shop? Did he
the
have
shop
it still?
Closed. The shop closed before I was born.
But do you have like memories of Arthur Ave? Did you?
Oh my God! The place next to it was Borgatti's, which is the across from the church.
Yeah,
which is where they make fresh pasta. We used to go. We used to go to Arthur Avenue every weekend, and the fresh pasta with like the cornmeal dusting.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing, those things from childhood that are, like, defining? Like, I've only been to Arthur Avenue once. It's just mind-blowing because it just doesn't exist anywhere, man. They're, like, out here or almost any other city. There's only a few cities where you have real... The reason why Italian food is good is there's Italians there.
Yes.
Yeah.
and I remember when we went to... You know, I grew up Arthur Avenue. We go to the market, and the market had... There was a stall where people bought live chickens.
Yeah.
And there was, like, the butcher where it was, like... real butcher.
Taking like, apart the whole cow.
Like
the,
oh, that's an animal
being no denying it.
Deconstructed in front of us.
Yeah.
And then I remember the first time when we went to, my family went to Italy, you know, when I was in 17 or so.
Yeah.
And I was like completely familiar. I was like, oh, this is,
sure?
This is like Arthur Avenue.
Yeah, yeah. So does your mom speak Italian?
She doesn't, no. She's, her folks did, but she does not.
So what'd your dad do? See, but you're not all Italian.
So my dad grew up in Chicago and was a Jesuit seminarian.
He was going to be a priest.
Spent
man of the cloth.
7 years in the seminary. Lived in Peru for a year.
Doing missionary work.
Yeah, I mean, like in basically the poor, what are called the barriadas outside Lima. Yeah, not missionary work. That's not real. The Jesuits are not like super.
No, they work out of a church.
Yeah, they do a lot of like social justice work and sort of helping the poor and stuff like that.
So that's what he did?
He did that, and then he came back and he ended up at Fordham, you know, which is Jesuit school, to sort of finish his education.
Brendan went there.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. Fordham looms large in my life because a lot of the people that would later form my parents' social circle came out of Fordham because it was all these kind of social justice lefty Catholics.
Yeah.
And so my dad and his like cohort of seminarian friends rented an apartment near Arthur Avenue and Marion Avenue that was one floor up from the one my mom grew up in that she lived in. And it was through that they met.
And that he gave up the priesthood?
So the story officially always, and my parents will listen to this.
Yeah.
So the story officially always is that he had decided to leave before meeting my mom. But, you know, my mom has told this story about when they first started hanging out, like my dad had the collar.
Right.
Like
she knew.
I mean, her mom, when it became clear there was something going on between them, was like, I think, like a bit scandalized in the beginning. Because like she had met this dude as like, oh, the nice Jesuit priest upstairs who wears the collar. And then it was like, wait a second.
So the story has been somewhat perhaps mythologized to take the onus off of your mother.
I sometimes have my suspicions that is the case. I don't know, but
the truth is there, Chris. Where's your journalistic integrity? Can't you push your mom a little bit?
I have not set them up for a grilling on this, but yeah, that's then they met and my dad had already at that point, through sort of being in the Jesuits, been doing these community organizing in poor neighborhoods in the U.S. in Chicago, in the Bronx. And so when they, you know, he left the priesthood and he and his friend from the same Jesuit class started an organization in the Bronx that was basically doing housing organizing against landlords. My mom was a teacher.
Yeah.
And I grew up in the Bronx in the 80s at a time when my dad was doing community organizing. And the Bronx was, you know, the Bronx in the 80s was like
gnarly.
I mean, I did not grow up in, you know,
the projects.
Or the South Bronx. You know, we lived in this neighborhood in the Northwest Bronx that was, you know, a standard kind of working class outer borough neighborhood. But, you know, the world that my parents' friends, who they're still very close to and are still this kind of world around me and my brother.
Yeah.
These were all people that were kind of like engaged, like community organizers, community activists in the Bronx in the 80s, like doing really, you know, amazing work.
It's interesting, though, because, like, you know, as much as the Catholic Church gets demonized and probably rightfully so for a lot of nefarious bullshit, you know, with money and predators, which I think has been going on for centuries.
Yeah.
I think people forget that there are a lot of the civil rights organizers. There was always the charitable arm and the community arm of the Catholic Church has done a lot of good.
Incredibly. And that tradition is an amazing tradition. I mean, the people that come out of the church with that kind of real godly commitment to the least of these.
Yeah.
When you encounter those folks, like, it is an amazing thing to encounter.
And those are your parents' friends.
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, in some ways, I mean, I you know, I don't want to, you know, they're not saints. I mean,
But they should be the first to admit that.
But they're, you know, my dad and my mom and the people around them were all people that were, you know, they were really doing the work.
Right.
It's like there was no glamour and there was no money
right.
in trying to save people from lead paint in the Bronx in 1985.
Right.
Like, you're just doing that because...
Isn't that interesting?
That's a good... You want to see the world be better, a better place, and that's the work you're going to do.
And that's what you grew up around.
Yeah.
And what did your mom do?
My mom was a teacher in the Bronx, and then stayed home for about 9 years with me and my brother, and then went back into education where she was a... She worked for an arts nonprofit in the Bronx, and yeah. did arts administration in the Bronx.
It's fascinating. So you grew up in this this weird environment of somewhat selfless activity.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, neither of my parents in the duration of my life ever worked a single day for a for-profit operation.
That's so anti-American.
Not a single day. Also, sort of none of their friends did either. I mean, yeah. everyone worked for either nonprofits or civil servant, the government. My dad ended up going to the health department where he did, he just retired, actually, where he worked in Harlem and, yeah. and other poor neighborhoods on public health stuff. So,
and did you, now, like, you know, there's something about, like, I don't know, like, on a spiritual level, I think this was something that's lost on a lot of people, that there is something about helping others that makes you feel good.
Yes.
and it does make the world a better place. But people have become very self-involved culturally now that, sometimes I have a slight sense of panic at the disconnect between human beings. But I've also found that, like, especially in New York City, and it's one of the only cities I've experienced it, is that, if someone goes down on the street, if something happens on the street in New York, it's astounding how many people are like, in there to help.
Yes.
Yeah, someone will immediately take charge.
It's funny because people have the opposite view of New York. There's like the famous Kitty Genovese, murder, the woman who, she was murdered in this courtyard in
right.
I think it was Queens, and she was screaming and no one helped. And this was like this sort of iconic moment of like the shame of New York City right. where like no one helps anyone. And my experience in New York is 100% the opposite.
Always,
like,
me too.
If someone's walking around with a map
yeah.
and, on the subway and they yeah. look like a little lost, it's like, yeah, moths people. To a flame of like you need yeah. directions,
and,
like,
and then when they walk away with them, at three people go, oh fuck, I don't think I told her. Hey, can
yeah,
you,
yeah, exactly. It's absolutely no, it's absolutely true. Like,
how many people I've given directions, and 2 minutes later, I'm like, oh shit, that's the wrong, the fucking wrong train, getting the wrong train. Happens all the time. I don't know.
Enjoy Coney Island.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, it'd be good for you, an adventure. But no, but it's true. So how did that mold you? I mean, like, we're like, seeing this. What were the expectations out of you? Were you brought up Catholic?
So yeah, we were brought up Catholic.
So your dad's a believer.
He is a believer. Yeah, I went to church every Sunday. I went to CCD on Wednesdays and then on Sundays.
I don't even know what CCD is.
I don't even know what it stands for. Really? Sunday school, catechism.
Okay, all right. You don't know what it stands for?
No.
Come on, Chris. You're the wizard.
I used to get out of, school early on Wednesdays and yeah. go over. And then, so yeah, my brother and I both raised Catholic.
The fear of hell.
We had Catholicism. Like, my father was raised in a Catholic home where it was like, old school Catholic.
Right.
Like, his parents, until the day they died, went to church every morning. They were incredibly devout.
Yeah.
They were incredibly anti-abortion.
He's not Italian, your father.
No, he's Irish Catholic.
Okay. So there you go. The two.
Yeah. Exactly.
but I guess also there's a practicality to coming from his generation of Catholics and somebody as dedicated to the work, the social work of Catholicism. I think that when you live that life, you're a little more practical about putting the fear of God into your kids.
Absolutely. Like, we did not grow up in a home where, I did something and then was consumed by guilt that I was going to go to hell.
Right.
But I think that's my dad's generation of Catholics. Right. That's sure. their experience of the religion. I mean,
right.
And I think it was incredibly, it turned so many off. I mean, there's so many people,
yeah.
the FARC, fallen away Roman Catholic.
Yeah.
Who were just completely scarred.
Yeah.
At 6 or 7, being urged to contemplate eternal torture and damnation because you took a piece of gum out of the drawer you shouldn't have.
Right.
Which was a lot of people, that generation's experience of Catholicism is still today, I'm sure, some.
Well, I think they did, the family or the parents would display some of the disciplinary action onto the church.
Absolutely.
So, like, yeah. It afforded them a little bit of freedom just to let the church terrify their children.
That is, I think that's really true. Or in the cases of the nuns.
Yeah.
The school,
the shit out of the kids.
Yes, beat the crap out of them, and also the school discipline, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's like these are all sort of tools in the tool chest. For confining the behavior of children. Is there's like, do this because I said so, and then there's like, do this because if you don't, you will burn in hell for eternity.
Just generations of self-loathing, guilt-ridden.
It's screwed a lot of people up. I mean, it's funny because I am no longer a believer, and yet. I'm both no longer a believer, and yet my feelings about the kind of Catholicism I got are largely positive and warm.
Do you know the day that happened? Like when
yes, I do.
Really?
Yeah. I got to Brown University freshman year.
Brown.
And I was
what year did you graduate?
2001.
Uh huh.
And I was committed to going to church.
Yeah. And when you got to Brown?
When I got to Brown.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, when you're 18 or whatever, 19, like, you know, waking up early at Brown, like,
to go to church.
It's, you know,
you're there with celebrity kids and legacies and smart liberals.
And
you needed some sort of order. Yeah, I mean, it seems like.
I think I had some sense that it was an interesting test of my faith that if I was going to do this while I was by myself. And I remember going to early that fall. I went to Mass and the priest gave a homily about the passage in the gospel in which Jesus said, "What God has joined, let no man rend it asunder." And that is—I
don't even know what that means.
It's about divorce, basically. Okay. It's basically the the kind of theological basis of the church's objection to divorce,
right?
And he just went on this like long anti-divorce homily, and I was just like, "I'm out."
Really?
I just was like, this is...
That's when Jesus left you?
I was just like, this is preposterous. And I think that my response to him in that homily in that moment was less theological and more just like political or practical.
Sure.
But what it meant was, I was just like, I got no time for this. And then I just stopped going. And then once I stopped going, and then I started studying philosophy as the thing that I did all the time. I just came to the belief that, you know, there is no God.
It was rational.
Yeah.
You broke it down.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that, like, I don't say that in any sense of, like, that is the one truth. Like, was the conclusion I came to, but the conclusion was preceded by the ebbing of practice. You know, my point is that, like, all of these things about our belief systems are inextricably bound to our habits and practice and life world.
Sure.
Like,
it's a control thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's the way we control. Mm-hmm. The crazy amount of stimulus that pour into our life.
And also it's just the sort of the repetition. I think that, you know, a lot of religion is like sort of encouraged OCD with ideology. You know, like there's a repetition of ritual and whatnot that it kind of grounds you in something. Because just when you're untethered, it seems like you sort of used your brain to sort of tether you. But a lot of people, you know, they don't want to execute that. So they're just sort of like, they keep the order going.
Yes. I mean, I had a friend of mine who became very religious after being not that religious, who basically said that to me.
Oh, really?
Like,
I just need something to keep me angry.
Not only that, but that people do. And that, like, he sort of now looks at secular folks as like just like adrift. Like, how do you even...
Well, you got your iPhone now and it takes up a lot of There's a lot of distractions. I've been doing
refresh. Refresh.
I've been working on a bit of. I just started doing this bit of that. Like, I don't know if it's my age or what, but like, you know, if I set my phone down for a few minutes, I get an existential terror. It's almost like when I set my phone down, it's like I'm dying. Give me the phone. Where's Twitter?
You can feel that. Like, it's physically like in the chest.
Yeah.
In the same place that real like panic attacks or anxiety starts, like,
and that your heart is, and that you should be okay. Like, I drive home sometimes, I don't put the radio on. Do you take time? Do you, like, because, you know, meditation is a practice which I don't do unless I'm just in my car, but like, just to feel silence and the tactile sensations of like having your hand on a wheel and just knowing that the vessel you're occupying is temporary. It's just like, maybe I'm going too far with it. I should be thinking about other things, but I feel it now. I don't know how old you are, but in your life, did you you did not have a spiritual craving, or did you find a higher purpose? I mean, were you looking for answers?
No, I think my, I think I'm a person whose sort of biological makeup, neurological makeup is disposed to anxiety.
Me too. It's like, it's horrible. And sometimes I think it's getting a little worse.
Really?
Dread.
Yeah. Yes. Dread. And dread and nostalgia in this potent mix of like, I think.
Explain that to me a little bit.
The way that
the poetry of that.
The way that my anxiety has always manifested to me is just the keen awareness of the onrush of time towards permanent non-existence.
But that's not necessarily nostalgic unless you sort
no,
of
but
engage.
It could be in these specific moments where you the nostalgia will rise up, and
that's where I went to college. That's
yes, and then it's like.
Right. And you
that kind of like tunnel feeling of it's all passing, it's all passing. And I also understand that getting back to this religion thing about how if I really did believe in an actual sense in an afterlife, like that would be
relieving,
massively mitigating.
Well, that's the big pitch.
That's the big pitch. And like, it's like awesome. Like if you believe that in your cells, like that's great. Like I would love to feel that way. I would love to not feel.
It's like having health care. It's very similar.
Eternal.
That's why Canadians are sort of like, you know, kind of cool. I mean, they're not incredibly interesting all the time, but there's some basic thing that they relaxed about.
Yeah.
Well, I understand that, and I feel the anxiety, and I think after a certain point in your life, it becomes like it's interesting that you know somebody that turned back to religion because for me it's like. Once you go through a rational period or you've turned your back on religion or you were never prone to a spiritual search or a need for a God to sort of come to one at 60 or 70 years old, it's almost sort of like I'm gonna turn that part of my brain off. I've had enough working the angles. So now I'm just sort of like, yeah, there's a God. And now I'm going to just relax.
I just wonder all the time about whether, like, I find that process fascinating because it's unclear to me whether you can will yourself to that or how that comes about.
The suspension of disbelief?
Yeah, like.
Yeah, it's
like,
crazy. Yeah, yeah. So how do you deal with your anxiety? What do you just do? Just overwork?
Yeah, overthink? I mean, I think focus on the things, like, I actually find there's some people who have anxiety that is exacerbated by having, like, a lot of tasks.
Yeah.
And mine is in some ways the opposite. Like having goals and projects is what I find is the most satisfying way. Like the concreteness of embedding myself in the finishing of a task is I find like incredibly satisfying. And so that's the show every day. I got to make a show every day.
Yeah.
That's longer term writing projects. That's like the projects to me is the thing that really like makes me feel relieved of that.
And do you find that like because a lot of this stuff you're writing about things outside of you? I mean, you know, how much like of your, you know, your heart and mind and your personal, you know, sphere is being avoided?
Right. Like, do you
how much of your life is just specifically about avoiding the terror?
No, I mean, I think we all, right? We all cope with it. It's like the human condition, right? Yeah. So I think, you know, I have kids now. And
how many?
I have two.
Yeah. Oh, so that's full time.
Yeah. I mean, like, and that actually, like, I've been away from my family. This is as long as I've been away from the kids. We left on Friday.
A week.
You know, it's going to end up being like eight or nine days. And it's a really fascinating thing about.
Doing the FaceTime.
Yeah. What I do with my 3-year-old is I like send her these little dispatches that I like record
videos?
And I text it to her and then she texts me one back. And
great.
I do these like sort of like quasi news report, you know, where I'm we're about to, this is a helicopter that fights fires and we're going to go up in that. And,
oh, you do that?
Yeah. And that's then I send it to her and she sends me questions back.
So you're actually, you know, you're doing a show for your child.
I'm doing a show for my child. Yeah. Exactly.
It's Chris Hayes, your dad.
Good evening from California. I'm your dad.
I'm on location. So what was did you study philosophy? Was that your major?
Yeah, that was my major. In fact, it was philosophy of math and science. And
oh, so my God. Jesus.
I did advanced deductive logic and Gödel's proof.
But that's math.
It was math. Yeah, it's math. Yeah.
So you didn't dick around with like Spinoza and whatnot?
I did some of that too. Like I took existentialism and I took epistemology and stuff like that. But I was specifically on the philosophy of math.
The logic track.
The logic track.
Yeah, it's the numbers don't add up. So that's clearly not true.
Exactly. I remember I had this experience. This really insane experience where when you're moving apartments at some point, you know, and you're taking your, you know, that talk about like a nostalgia opportunity, right? Yeah. When you have to go through your books and like you're taking
I'm
off
surrounded
the
shelf. By this shit. There's shit I've gotten from college that I still think I'm going to read. I still think I'm going to read some of this shit. A Thousand Plateaus by Deleuze and Guattari.
let's make a wager right now.
I did some underlining in there at one point. Did you read that book? You know those guys?
Yes.
What was that about?
I don't know.
All right.
I have no...
Okay. I'm never going to get
but
to
I had
it.
But I had this experience where one of the books I took off was one of my deductive logic books from college.
Yeah.
And I open it up, and in the margins are these just furious, extensive notes. Yeah. And it literally might as well have been written in Chinese. Like, I could not believe that the person who wrote those notes was a version of me who understood any of this.
Yeah.
Because it was so remote to me.
Yeah.
I was just like...
Yeah, it's weird, right?
Who was that person? That was me, but I don't... Yeah. I can't make sense of any of this anymore.
You're loading your brain up. You were in it.
Yeah, I was in it.
You're training.
Yes.
So... What was the original idea? What did you want to do with your life when you were in college? I mean, I know you ended up the journalist and this guy that hosts a show and is fighting the good fight, but you must have been more selfish at some other point.
Well, yeah, no, I really wanted to be a performer. I wanted to be a theater. I mean, I did a ton of theater.
Really?
Yeah.
Like plays?
Yeah.
You were an actor guy?
I was a director, actor. I directed my friends wrote a musical I directed. I did a solo show my senior year. I acted. I was in Three Sisters. I wrote plays. I wrote a lot.
Wrote plays?
Yeah.
Got how many?
Three or four, probably.
Really?
Yeah.
Full three act? Or
Like one full three act. And
no shit.
Smaller ones. So, one act solo show.
When are you going to get back to that?
I want to, actually.
You do?
Yeah, I do. I definitely... at some point want to do theater again.
What would it take? It seems like you have a mission. So how does a guy like you just pull out to do some theater?
That's a good question. I mean, that's an unanswered question. I'm did you do theater?
I wrote a couple of plays.
Yeah, I knew that.
But I didn't, you know, I was, you know, it was not the theater school, but I did, acted and, you know, I directed and I was, you know.
I mean,
but I ended up pursuing that. I tried the save the world route for a few years and I was like, I'm too selfish for this. Get back to talking about myself.
Well, I mean, the world is great and all, but
yeah,
I think part of what I love best about the show now or doing the work I do is that it there's some part at which it feels like we make a play every day.
Yeah.
Like there's a bit of that, like esprit de corps, like, we're making a show, and
right.
and the show sure, has sure. to come together. And there's lights and tech, and
yeah, you're kind of in show business.
Yeah, I mean, in a way,
it's all show business, news,
it's all
everything.
It's
sure,
all shows.
There's a lot of things that you guys do up
performing.
There.
Performing,
yeah.
But I miss the theater. I loved it. Was
like, who are your guys? Like, who are your playwrights?
You know, Designated Mourner, by Wallace Shawn.
I don't know if I've read it, but
it's really that's like my sort of aesthetic, which is a sort of like long and ruminative monologue driven kind of.
I think I read The Fever.
Yes, right. Well, The Fever's great.
Yeah, yeah.
The Fever's
yeah,
great.
Yeah.
And then I also like musicals a lot. Like this show that I'm on Broadway, which is by a friend of mine, Hamilton. Is, you know, it's about Alexander Hamilton, this hip-hop musical about Alexander Hamilton. And I think there's two types of people in the world, people who, like, love musicals and hate musicals, basically. It's, like, a very polarizing...
Well, I think the people that hate musicals are afraid of themselves. Like, I know, like, there's a certain, you know, I think slightly macho posturing
yes.
that goes in.
Yes.
Because, like, you know, I find that if I go to a musical, I don't seek them out, but if I do, I'm just crying immediately.
Exactly.
Because people are singing. It seems so vulnerable to me.
It is I could not agree more. Like, there is something that a musical can do at some switch it turns on emotionally that is, for me, nothing else reaches.
It's crazy. I don't know why I don't seek them out. You know what I mean? Because I feel like if I do, I have to change my lifestyle. I don't know who I'd be anymore.
The kind of person.
Yeah, yeah. I got to be. I'm the musical guy.
Oh, I'm going to Phantom.
Yeah, I'm going to see it again. It's the 20th time. It never gets old for me. I'm going to be one of those guys.
There are people like that.
I know. I know. I got a friend who's a really kind of like cranky, cantankerous dude. Who I've known for years, and he literally will take. He lives in New Mexico, where I grew up, and he goes to New York once a year just to go to musicals. It's like he gets it out of his system. But well, that's interesting. So you wrote a musical, or you just directed one?
I directed a musical that my friends had written that we did at college my junior year.
So when did your heart break, and you decide that was not a practical future for you?
Well, I got to college, and my now wife and I moved to Chicago. And I basically, for the first few years that I was in Chicago.
Why Chicago?
She's from Chicago.
Right.
I had family there. My dad's from Chicago.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was so much cheaper than New York. Oh, and that was the big reason.
And it's interesting. It's actually over time, I've sort of been to enough cities where I know the cities that, you know, actually kind of are authentic in their own thing. I mean, there's a lot of cities that, you know, I don't want to piss off any cities. But like, there's a few cities in America that are just sort of like, this is, you know, a real deal kind of historic thing that still survives. There's this organic nature to it. And that's one of them, right?
Yep.
It's its own thing.
It's its own thing. And it's also like, because of the cost of living relative to other sort of cultural meccas that people will go to is so low. What you get in Chicago is there was all these people in their 20s.
Right.
Like, you know, paying $250 a month in rent, $300 a month in rent, and then maybe waiting a table here or two, but then like writing their show or doing comedy or painting. There was a lot of space for people to kind of pursue kind of work or do really amazing, like, you know, social justice work. And all of that in some ways was facilitated by how much cheaper living there
was. It was like New York in the 70s.
Right, exactly. Right.
Like, yeah, there was a time where a lot of cities had that, but now it almost doesn't exist anymore. Not even where it's supposed to exist. And I think that's kind of diminished the arts communities in general.
Absolutely.
Like, if you can't have a bunch of poor creative people living somewhere and, you know, six to a loft.
Right. That is what facilitates. I mean, when we think about these places that were that, you know, the Lower East Side in the 80s.
Yeah.
They were that because it was cheap.
Yeah, it was all about space.
Yeah.
It's having the space to work and to create and to put on shows. And, like, you could do it. Like, you know, like, we got a loft and we're, you know, we're putting on a show.
We put on, even when I was 27, 28, a buddy of mine who I'd gone to college with and done theater with, like, I just directed a solo show of his in the basement of the apartment that we had.
It's great.
And we got this was not legal in any code sense, but we got like 100 people in there.
I think you're all right. There's a statute of limitations.
Yeah, exactly. There's Chicago Fire Department.
There's not going to be some right-wing rag going, Hayes broke the fire code in Chicago, putting on his lefty plays. But, well, what do you think about that? I mean, how do you feel, you know, when people talk about the National Endowment and about the necessity of arts and culture? I mean, it seems to me that even creative people, like I even become condescending. Like I did a stand-up show that they have once a month or something at this collective, you know, downtown here that do that kind of stuff, that do plays, that do, you know, provocative political stuff. And you know, I've seen that all. We've seen it before, whatever it is, but this is another generation doing that. But there's part of me that thinks, like, you know, this has been done before.
Yeah.
But how does that nourish, you know, have you thought about that? You know, what the arts actually do and what their place is?
I have. I mean, my mom worked in the arts, was like an arts administrator and worked for this nonprofit in the arts.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think for me personally, the most important training I got for my life was through the theater I did in high school and college.
Really? How so?
A huge part of adult life
yeah.
the two biggest things about adult life, I find.
Yeah.
It's presentation, like occupying your space, standing in, looking someone in the eyes, delivering to them, and collaboration, like working with other people to make a thing work. And we had this student-run theater at Brown where we, you know, we controlled the building. We got to, and we would have these long meetings where we would decide who's going to, you know, all these applications, and we'd fight over who's going to get the space for the next show. That was closer to adult life than any other thing I did in my 4 years at a, you know, great university. Because it was just about the basic mechanics of group decision making and collaboration. And so I think that this is in some ways a practical argument for how important the arts are, but just I think like every kid should have that awakened in them.
The creativity and the collaboration.
The creativity, the collaboration, the sense of like, I can make a thing with my friends. I can, you know, and how do we do that? And how do we skirt around conflict? And how do you win an argument in the room? You know, like those were meetings. That's all they were, which is like the least glamorous parts of the part of the arts.
Yeah.
But also for me, the most instructive.
I understand what you're saying about collaboration and arts, but there's also something about the freedom of expression.
Yeah.
Right. You know, on an individual basis.
Yes.
I mean, I hear what you learned, but I always wonder, like, you know, people get so self-involved and not entitled, but everybody's expecting to win the lottery or be the next genius. And there's not a lot of sort of attention paid to the act of expressing
that
yourself.
Yes. I mean, the difference between doing a thing because it will get recognition and doing a thing because that thing expresses something or fulfills you.
Yeah.
It is so hard in a media landscape that is, in a very literal fashion, built upon the endorphin rush of the ping of recognition.
And also, it's very accessible. I mean, you know, there is the ping of recognition, but now anybody, like, there's something about the very design of content, or what people call content, is that, and there's a freedom to it. Like, hey, everybody can do their little thing and put it up on YouTube. And, you know, with or without the expectation, you know, I think it's great that everyone has a voice and that they can show it. But I mean, but, you know, some voices are better than others.
Sure.
And that's just the way it is. But there is a way to nourish a delusion around, like, you know, putting things out in the world with these expectations.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I really early on when I first started doing journalism, freelance writing when I was in Chicago.
Oh yeah, let's get to that. What made you go like, nah, the arts aren't
well, good. I would do them both. I was doing theater and I was doing some freelancing. And this relates to this point in that I would write articles and they would be in the Alternative Weekly.
Yeah.
And then like poof.
They'd be gone. No internet yet. Yeah.
Very early. I mean, there was internet, but these articles weren't.
So you had to walk down the street with somebody and get the free paper and
I would go the first day that I had a byline. It was in the winter and I got on the bus and rode it south on Clark Avenue knowing that the van that dropped off the free paper came from downtown. And I went south until I hit a bookstore that I knew that was south enough to have it, and I got them. They were like fresh off the press. I grabbed it and like saw my byline.
I
still remember that moment. Amazing moment.
It's greatest.
But it's also, what I came to realize is that it was going to be a path to misery for me if the way that I valued the work was the reaction it got, because sometimes it would get a reaction, sometimes it just like dissipated. And so in the same way that you're saying,
you really realized that at that point?
I really did, yes.
As opposed to like, you know, that's not some sort of, you didn't, retrofit that?
No, I realized it in that moment. Now, I have lost sight of that a million times since.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I can hold that in my mind intellectually.
That's a result of what you were talking about before, this weird endorphin, clickbait, immediate gratification media situation we have. So you fall victim to that because now you're making a show that's out in the world and you're like, did it go viral? Or did anyone pick up on that?
Yeah.
Did it get traction?
Yeah.
So it's not...
As opposed to like, did we make a thing that was good?
Right.
A good thing in the world that I'm proud of?
Yeah.
As a little thing.
Did we chip away
at
the big problem?
Yes.
All right, so you start by doing, but also it's interesting, and how you talk about theater is that's also something that happens with community organizing. That's also something that, like, you know, you were in a creative environment, but it sounds to me, you know, from what I've read and about people who do it, specifically our president, and about what you're saying about your father, I mean, that whole undertaking of facilitating social change on that level is completely crazy in terms of, like, you know, sitting in a room full of people and making decisions.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And in both ways, sitting in a room full of people and making decisions, and also you can't be looking for recognition or, like, victories every day.
No,
I mean, most of the time you're just there one cares and you're losing.
Right. That's fucking mind blowing to me. And that's what people don't realize. Like, you know, I pulled myself out of the political dialogue because I knew I was a fraud on some level in that, like, you know, yeah, I was angry. I was concerned. I'm a bright guy. But, you know, bloviating about something or taking bits of news and going like, fuck the power. You know, that's all fine. But the way shit gets done is in rooms full of people that know they're losing,
right?
You know, making incremental growth for people that have nothing.
Yeah.
That's where it happens. It's not some dude, like, you know, pounding his hand, you know, on television.
Well, look, I don't hear.
Well, no, and that wasn't a shot at you.
No. believe me, I have no illusions about my relative efficacy compared to the people that do the kind of work you're talking about. But I do think, here's my feeling about sort of this in general, which is on a kickoff in a football team.
Yeah.
All right. The way a kick is covered is everyone has to stay in their lane and not all chase the ball. Because if everyone chases the ball, you open up a huge gap for big returns. And so there's this incredible impulse to chase the ball because you're like, the guy's there. I want to go tackle him. And you are coached, keep in your lane, because if you chase, that opens up an opportunity for a big run back, right? And I sort of think about social change like people all have their lanes.
Yeah.
Like, so your lane.
But is everyone happy in their lanes?
I don't know if they are, but I do think that, like, not everyone's going to do the same thing, right? And there's all sorts of different things people can do that actually do, like, make the world a better place.
All right, so you're writing for the alt paper in Chicago, doing your plays.
Yep.
It's walking around in your heavy overcoat.
All three of those are exactly correct.
you stayed with the woman that you met back then.
Yeah, we've been together since we were 19.
Yeah, so yeah, that's something. What happens? What makes you leave behind you know, the arts and really start to, what did you decide your mission was?
It was less a decision and more that it was easier to make a living, and I was getting more traction writing as a journalist. And I ended up getting a full-time job at a small lefty magazine called In These Times in Chicago.
Uh-huh. I remember that magazine.
It's been around forever. It's still around.
Yeah.
It's great. And I honestly think, like, if someone had hired me to be the artistic director of a small theater company, like,
the missed opportunity.
I would have done that, and
you'd still be there. You'd be the old guy.
I would still be there.
He was here in 1980. Yeah, he's been here for 20 years. That guy. Yeah, probably drinking a little.
Probably very different. No, I mean, I think I'd be happy doing that too. So basically, I just started getting more traction. And then also there was this era right around sort of 2004, 2005, where the internet starts to really, that kind of, like, that moment, which you, I'm sure, remember, because that was sort of the same moment of kind of peak anti-Bush mobilization, Air America, all this stuff, the Netroots, the blogosphere. At that moment, then all of a sudden there's this way for the work I'm doing in Chicago to start finding this larger and larger audience through the internet.
Yeah.
And as I'm doing that work and writing it and they're getting a little recognition, that sort of sends me on the path towards, you know, doing what I'm doing now.
Well, what in terms of social responsibility, obviously you were wired because of your childhood and because of the models you had in your family and your old man and whatnot. What was driving you? What was the one thing that was sort of, like, outside of just basic lefty politics? I mean, everybody sort of locks into one thing. What was it that made you be like, you know, this has got to be fucking changed?
I don't know. I mean, it's so a sense of sort of justice, injustice.
Yeah.
Political commitment is so essential to who I am and how I was raised.
Right.
It's almost impossible for me to like pull it out and look at it and examine it. You know, it's a very visceral thing. It's like, I can't imagine not feeling that way.
Right.
About things.
Right.
In the world.
What do you think is it like, if you were to like to separate the social conservatives and to separate, you know, sort of the hate mongering and the divide and conquer, you know, nature of right wing media and everything else, there are conservatives that believe that their way is correct.
Oh yeah, 100%.
And then there are lefties that believe that, you know, this is the way to life. What is the primary difference in your mind when you strip away the bullshit?
That's
because it seems like the righties, real conservatives are almost Darwinian, that if you can't survive or win and do it without government help, that you know, you're just, what are you gonna do? You're just gonna accept your lot in life.
I think there are competing values about what a good society and a good life are, and there are, and again, this gets back to this sort of visceral sense, like, mm-hmm. I have a visceral sense of like equality and fairness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a visceral sense of, say, purity.
Right.
I just don't. It doesn't like, it doesn't scan to me.
Yeah. What was that indicate?
You know,
purity.
The sanctity of like marriage is like a pure institution that's being like infected by gay marriage, for instance.
Right. Right. Right? Well, those are social issues, but there are these economic issues that seem to like the difference in
right. Where like fairness, so yeah, here's another example. Like I have a sort of visceral attachment to fairness,
right?
Whereas I just like, I don't, that sort of visceral libertarian impulse of like,
yeah,
step off and get off my back,
right? Right,
like,
right.
The place where politics really functions, which is like in the like flushed cheeks at a Thanksgiving dinner table, that is related to but distinct from all these arguments we have.
Right,
like, there's some moral intuitions that people have, whether they're born with them, whether they get them through life experience, that there are things that fire them morally,
yeah,
that are wrong and right, and conservatives and liberals have different things that kind of fire them up morally,
yeah.
You know, and it can be very hard. Like, it is hard to put myself in the shoes of people that viscerally feel angry about air regulations, or angry about light bulb. You know, this was like a pet cause for a while, was
changing the light bulb, yeah, to more energy efficiency.
And I can understand, like, oh, I can understand big interests that want to diffuse regulations, which a lot of that was just astroturf for them.
Well, they were just dragging angry people along.
But that's the thing, is that argument that you're going to have to change your light bulbs, like, that captivated something in some segment of people, and it is now impossible for me to make the empathic leap into the shoes of a person who is really angered by that.
I
can think about it and I can analyze it. I could report on and talk to people that feel that way, but there are certain things that it's just very difficult to be like.
Of course, because like they're angry about other things. They've just been sparked, you know, by garbage. Like the you know, these people are walking around feeling like they've been gypped and they didn't get theirs. And like, that's that whole thing, is how do the Republican Party, you know, convince people to vote against their economic self-interest? You know, how do they do that?
I don't buy that argument in some ways. Or what I want to do is I want to approach politics in which I grant people, regular people. We're not talking about like corporations who are trying to, you know what I mean? We're talking about like actual people who actually have politics, like people that walk around, have jobs, you know, whatever. We're not talking about like, you know, a coal company that's like, we don't believe in EPA regulations.
Right.
I want to grant people that their beliefs have as much sort of like, not legitimacy as in their right, but integrity, that they are about what they say they are.
But you can't empathize with those people.
I just can't put myself into the mind space. I can sort of try to understand and see where they're coming from. But I just think there are certain irreducible moral instincts we
have. Sure, but I think most people have them, and there's a belligerence that is stoked. that like I realized this the other day, is that the democracy really depends, democracy functioning really depends on the number of people that are okay. Not great,
yeah.
Not shitty.
Right.
I'm okay. You know, that I got problems. Yes. And yeah. So
there's that Freud line about how the point of analysis is to turn like unsparing misery into ordinary unhappiness.
Right.
I think it's a line. Like, it's like
they're similar, right? So I feel like even with gay marriage, even with the people that like it becomes the evolution of democracy or a culture, the reason it's difficult is that, you know, people are stuck in this way of thinking. But eventually, once something becomes, you know, legitimized legally or otherwise or culturally, you know, those people that are like, that's fucking horrible. But within a certain amount of time, they're like, nah, I guess it's just the way it is now. Like they will accept it. And it seems that the people on the margins who continue to push back against it are become a minority. And that's the way democracy works. Yeah. Is that people aren't necessarily happy with the collective decision, but eventually they suck it up and they live their fucking life.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the light bulb stuff and that stuff is just people holding on to something that they feel is being like, you know, like this isn't what it used to be.
Well, that, yes. And that feeling, that intuition, that thing that like, it's not the way things used to be.
Right.
One of the fascinating things is that as you get older, it becomes easier to sympathize with that instinct.
Well, yeah, but also
the kind of like old man yells at cloud kids these days, get off my lawn.
That's
like,
right.
That used to be a thing I had no subjective access to and is now a thing I have subjective access to.
Right.
Because I will feel that way sometimes about things that 14-year-olds are doing and pictures they're taking of themselves and putting online.
Yeah,
I have this very conservative impulse, which is like, No,
stop that.
Don't do that.
Yeah,
don't
do that.
Like that we didn't in my day we didn't do that.
I wonder what it really does. But also like that type of nostalgia that you know we're talking about and this used to be for the weird thing about it is it was before anyone even having experience of it. Whatever this used to be is, this normal way of living that was once America is before my lifetime, really. You know, like I'm 63. So in 1963, I mean, that's not the whatever people. Oh, yeah. No, I'm, 1963 I was born.
Born in 1963. Yeah. You just said I'm 63 and I was like, what the?
But I think a lot of people are holding on to something they never even had experience of. It's an idea.
Yes, but there's some, I may be misquoting this, but there's some ancient tablets from like Sumeria that are about like, you know,
the good old days?
Kids these days, basically.
Well, yeah,
like,
I get that.
You know what I mean? Like, there is this, like, eternal sense of, as part of the human condition, like, there was this thing before we came, this thing to which we will return.
But I think what the real threat to people like you and I, or maybe what I'm projecting onto you, is that it's more than just kids these days. It is the deterioration of real community. And it seems that, oddly, people that have less have a tighter sense of community. That I think that if you talk about class issues, you know, the one reason why whatever the lower class is survives is because, for better or for worse, their communities are much stronger.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this trade-off that happens as societies get richer or people get richer, in which people move around a lot more, right?
Yeah.
Like, the idea that, you know, I know people who have, you know, people my parents' age who have five kids who live in five different cities.
Yeah.
Like, that would have just been unthinkable.
Sure, stay in the neighborhood.
That's insane, right? And there's a trade-off there. The trade-off is people move because they have opportunities and they like different parts of the country.
Yeah.
And the thing they give up is, you know, we're all in the same neighborhood and grandma and grandpa are here and they'll watch
family.
You after school. And that stuff is, you know, that's a tangible and real loss
to not
have that. Like, I right now... Like, I live in New York City, and my brother lives a mile and a half away. I live in Brooklyn. My parents live in the Bronx. I love having my, like, particularly when you've got kids, and we go up to my folks' house on the weekend. We have, like, my mom makes amazing Italian food, and we just got a bigger car so we can give my brother a ride back from from the Bronx down to Brooklyn. Like, that is really, that's special.
And that's theoretically what it should be about, right?
Yeah.
So what do you think, like, as a guy that's on the pulse of this and as someone who is out here, you know, reporting on the drought, literally, like, you know, because the tone of reporting and the tone of you know, the way news is presented and just the media in general, that there's this almost kind of compulsive, you know, predatory necessity to get things that capture people's imagination over news. And there is a sense that, you know, we're just, you know, spiraling towards the end every day.
Yeah.
And I tend to believe that might not necessarily be true.
You're right. I mean, basically, I would say bad news, good news, right?
Yeah.
Bad news is that, like, A, this is the Western United States is a dry place that exists because of unbelievably expensive, aggressive, and remarkable water projects.
Right.
Right?
Okay.
As a general matter. Like,
yeah.
There's not enough water here.
It was invented.
Yeah, but of course everything's invented too. Like, there's sometimes there's like,
no, but I mean, like, it was the city was set up. It's what Chinatown's
about. Yeah, right.
About.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah,
we're
right,
going to divert
yeah.
water.
Yes. Right.
Right.
So, the bad news is that, like, it's bad. Like, it's literally the three driest years in the history of record keeping of California. Like, they've been keeping records since, you know, the mid 19th century.
Yeah.
Like, that's crazy.
It's bad.
And
all right, I'll water less.
The other bad thing is. It will be more like this as we go into the future. It will get drier and warmer.
Because of the bigger
issue.
Because
of climate change, yeah.
Right.
That's just, I mean, we can't be totally certain. Climate models are not certain, but everything suggests that's the case. The good news is, what's amazing is there's still actually a ton of waste in the system.
Yeah.
I had a guy on last night. We went to Central Valley. We saw this farmer who's drip irrigating, right? Half of the farmers in California still, to this day, use flood irrigation.
Right.
There is 60% of the water that is used in Los Angeles is basically treated wastewater that's flushed out to the sea because the idea of recycling that's so politically toxic, right?
See, this is the weird thing.
So the good news is there is actually still a tremendous amount of waste in the system, and there's tremendous innovations that can happen to just get more from less.
But this is these paradigm shifts that become impossible because of politically entrenched corporate interests who refuse to spend the money to make the changes necessary to service the better good for short-term profit or just to keep the model going.
Or in the case of water often, I mean, that might be true about sort of the agricultural reasons. And the water, like, you know, the idea of taking wastewater, which is, you know, wastewater.
Yeah.
And you can basically treat that to 100% purity, run it back through the system, and people are—that's politically toxic. And that's not corporate interest. That's just people being like,
"I don't want to drink shit."
Yes.
Hmm.
You know, I talked to the mayor 2 days ago, and he said, "You know, someone, you know, it had been dubbed toilet to tap, which he's like doesn't work, but we call it showers to flowers." And I was like, "You're right. Showers to flowers is better than toilet to tap."
Well, but that's one of those things I think that, you know, over time, if somebody would just have the courage to do it, people would eventually be like, "Ew, you know, I thought at first I would taste it, but I don't." I'm like, you know what I mean? Yeah, no, it's all right.
Good.
It's all right. It's all
pretty
right.
Good.
I mean, I don't
no, that you're exactly right. And eventually the pressures of all this will produce that. I mean, that.
But in the bigger sense, like, you know, in talking about like that, that's a political problem on people's sort of sensibilities. But like, what do you think is the great unraveling here? And I know that's a longer discussion, you know, but like you, to have a relatively corporate occupied government in the sense that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it doesn't serve the people. I mean, are we headed towards a divide between classes that it's going to just become a feudal state? I mean, what do you think?
I have weirdly become, I can be profoundly dispirited about the state of American democracy, particularly on this issue, the sort of concentration of wealth and the kind of feedback mechanism between the economy and the political system, because wealth gets concentrated. Those people have more money. They purchase more influence over the political system. The political system acts in ways that are favorable to them that further increases their wealth.
It's a money laundering
and
operation.
It sort of like loops through.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Here's what I think. The history of money in politics, particularly in America, and the history of American concentrations of wealth is that eventually some scandal and backlash happens. And I think the Citizens United era has unleashed what will certainly end in tears.
What does that mean exactly?
I don't know what it's going to look like, but there's going to be some huge scandal. There is going to be some huge scandal that involves some billionaire who funds some candidate and is obsessed with one little tiny loophole in the tax code. and that loophole gets stuck into a bill and no one knows who did it. And this guy gets a, you know, billion-dollar year tax rebate. I mean, I'm sort of crafting some sort of
This is the hope. This is where we find hope, is that the billionaire's tax loophole.
The hope is that it will there is some level at which people will react in disgust, and there is already a lot of disgust about the way that all this is concentrated. But there's going to be, I predict there will be a galvanizing scandal. I mean, people forget Watergate, which was about a million different things, was fundamentally a campaign finance scandal.
Yeah.
It was about the committee to reelect the president. It was about suitcases of cash. It was about all this sort of unaccountable money and the quid pro quo.
Aren't you underestimating, though, in sort of an optimistic way, the cynicism and detachment of the population?
Maybe, but I do think that, like, there's going to be some... The system can't keep running like this without producing a truly shocking scandal.
Okay.
That's my prediction.
Okay.
And I think there will be a moment when that truly shocking scandal happens for a whole reevaluation of the system that we've built. Because right now the thing that we're running, the experiment we're running, is insane. Mm-hmm. The rules are completely unclear. The FEC is totally deadlocked. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of millions and then billions of dollars that are going to slosh around this playing field that no one knows the rules for.
Uh-huh.
It's nuts. We've never done it before.
Well, that's why the entire banking system collapsed.
That is exactly why the entire banking system collapsed, and we are basically running an analog of that with the campaign finance system now.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, I guess let's hope for that
hope
crisis.
For crisis. No, hope for... Not crisis, but hope for a moment when the unsustainable ability of it becomes so evident that there is a sort of mass disgust. Yeah.
It's that is a naked lunch. The Burroughs line. It's the moment where everyone sees what's at the end of every fork or something.
Yes, that's.
Well, look, Chris, it was great talking to you.
Thank you.
I wish you best of luck with your playwriting career, and your return to the theater.
I want to do that.
I'm going to hold you to it.
All right.
Yeah, the day Chris Hayes gives up. In lieu of no crisis, I find it impossible to continue on, and I'm going to return to the theater. That's going to be a big day.
It's going to be a big day.
Thanks for talking.
Thanks.
Good guy, solid dude. Heart's in the right place, that Chris Hayes. I enjoyed talking to him. Look, folks, go to WTFpod.com. Get on the mailing list. I'll send you an email every week. Also get a little justcoffee.coop if you want. Pow! I just shit my pants. Classic justcoffee.coop plug right there for you. Haven't done one in a while. I was drinking iced tea, but, you know, things change. You know what I mean? Things change.
Boomer Lee!